Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006. Well, good evening and welcome to all of our guests and our panelists that have joined us and will be joining us this evening. This is your host, Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, and I want to thank you all for coming together with us in our family room this evening. We have been meeting here for almost, actually for 2 years. We've had some wonderful conversations, and we always try each week to find some subject that may be provocative.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Keep hold and you'll be able to listen to the show.
But
we want to let everyone have the opportunity to express our feelings and our thoughts concerning issues that pertain to us as African-American people. And so we have chosen a topic for tonight that just recently became news, and that has to do with the governor of Virginia, the Honorable Mr. Dr. Ralph Northam. Dr. Northam has been accused of appearing in a photograph in blackface next to another and another medical student. This is while he was in medical school. And the other student was dressed as a Ku Klux Klansman. And since this became public knowledge, there have been calls for him to resign. And so what we're going to discuss is whether or not he should resign amid allegations. Now, he said that wasn't him. And he said he's just finding out about this picture being in the yearbook. And I don't know if you can hear it, but
he said he's just finding out about this picture being in the yearbook. And it wasn't him. He said he did not buy a copy of the yearbook, so he had no way of knowing that this picture was in there. And he said that there have been instances with that yearbook where pictures got put on the wrong page.
So it's kind of
hard for me to believe he never saw his medical school yearbook after 30 years. That's really strange. I've seen it. I mean, I'm not saying that the picture could be another picture rather than his picture. And so what we're going to do is just to open up the floor. We want to welcome our regular veteran panelist, Mr. Bianchi. And so far, you're the only regular panelist. You're the only panelist that's dialed in so far. But we know that we have a global audience. We have people that do listen to the internet that don't want to come on and participate, don't want to give their opinions, but they listen. So even though it's right now, it's you and myself, we can go ahead with our conversation. And so I invite you, first of all, before you come in, I always like to ask you how you're doing. So how are you doing this evening, sir?
Well, you got feedback on your audio, Washington.
Yeah, I know. And I can't even hardly hear you. I'm getting ready to fix that.
Okay, that should be fixed now. I had actually 2 inputs into the audio, so now there should only be 1. Can you hear me okay better now?
Yeah, that works pretty good now.
Yeah, I see what the problem was. It was a tech issue. I'm glad you brought my attention, because I actually had inputs from 2 sources that were bumping against each other, so we should be better now. But anyway, so how are you doing this evening?
Well, I'm down here in Louisiana where the temperature's about 70 today. Well, I'm doing fine.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, you know, the majority of the country, even out on the West Coast, where they have a lot of flooding out there, Malibu, L.A., and, of course, up in the Northeast, you know, I saw where the temperature and
All them red, here. All them blue states.
Yeah, really. Well, if you mean blue in terms of
politics,
political,
yeah.
Yeah. You're something else. I have to give it to you. But the fact of the matter is that America's been hit very hard in these last couple of years.
What happened to the global warming?
Yeah, well, a lot of bad weather, especially in America. I don't know about far, far east. I hear that they've been having some problems over there, too, with floods and mudslides and tsunamis and stuff. I guess it's happening all over the world. Have you heard anything in your context of Africa? Have you heard anything about bad weather over there?
No. Everything's nice.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing. I guess a lot of people probably, if this keeps up, will be wanting to buy some land or lease some land over there to try to get away from these bad weather conditions. But anyway, to shift gears, today, because of what's in the news about Governor Dr. Ralph Northam, I wanted to go ahead and make that our topic for this evening. You probably seen the news that's been on the national TV news about him. But the question is, should he resign amid allegations that he appeared in blackface with another student?
To be honest, to a person, I would say no. But since he's Democrat, I say, yeah, gave him all their problem down in Alabama, try to do the same thing with Kavanaugh. So now you resign. Now, we take the politics out of it, I say no. And I say that, him signing the bill or the pretension of a bill that's going to allow women to abort babies up to the point where they're dilating. I say it again, up to the point where they're dilating. That there is more egregious, I think, than supposedly him dressing up in blackface. Heck, I don't see nothing wrong with that, especially during the time that it happened. Well, I mean, what's wrong with it? People was putting on costumes.
Yeah, that's interesting perspective. I wasn't aware of his position on abortion, and I certainly agree with you on that.
Well, you know what? New York passed the law, and Cuomo signed it. And when he signed it, the whole floor erupted in applause. Can you imagine that baby out on the table? Then they decide what to do with it.
If it's
the mother's health, the mental health, what does mental health and physical health got to do with saving a child, birthing a child?
Yeah. Well, we are totally on the same page with that because I'm totally against abortion. And certainly when the baby is obviously alive as a human being, which is the case here, to kill that baby for any reason, the only reason I could even imagine doing that, and I'm not even sure I would go there, since that baby was so totally deformed, that there was no chance for any kind of real life for that child. But even then, I would have second thoughts about it because that is God's creature. That's a human life. But, but getting back to the other issue, though, but he basically said that during that time, and we're only talking about 30 years ago. 30 years ago was in the 70s, and he's saying that back during that time where he came from in Virginia, that a lot of things happened that he would not participate in today that he participated in back there, which tells me that the civil rights movement, the human rights movement, the progress that supposedly was made after all of the demonstrations of Martin Luther King and all that did not have any effect on the people that he knew, including himself. But now that he's in politics, he's disowned all of that mentality, and he wants a pass. Even if he did do that, even though he says he didn't, And I'm saying, why don't he just come straight out and say that he was like most of the people from the country, not just the South, and they thought that they could make fun of black people and get away with it. Why don't he just admit it? I think people have more respect for him if he was just up front and honest about it than trying to weasel out of it. What do you think?
Well, like I said before, from a politics standpoint, being that he's a Democrat and how Democrats have waged this war against those on the other side for things that they'd done 40 years ago and nobody around but him, them and the accuser, in some cases, accusers came back and retracted and said they were lying. I think he should resign. Well, fair
because
enough is fair play.
Because,
yeah. Because of the politics. But as far as any other association with the pranks and that, I wouldn't have anybody to resign over that. It's just what people were doing back during those times. I mean, I'm sorry, you can find instances of that go on you know, blacks. And I would have to think mocked folks too. Heck, they look at the Polish people, the Polak. Look at all the Polak jokes. Of course, I can know blacks that is associated with the Klan. But you know who else wears a hooded outfit like that? In Spain, the Seville Knights. They dress up in. Have you ever seen them before?
I haven't, but you know, you made me think of down in South America. They have the people that wear the big heads of popular political or historic figures. And they have this parade, and people have these enormous heads that they wear representing these historic figures. But I think the context, even what you're referring to, is totally different, because that menstrualization of black people was designed to basically get laughter out of white people for looking at black people as being stupid, which I think is something that's real antisocial about that kind of attitude that will affect people's relationship, even when they're put in a position of power like the governor with the black people.
Well, let me ask you a question. What do you think about Amos and Andy and the Little Rascals?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked that, because when I answer that question, I'm also going to lock the Madea movies in with that, because all of this is basically the same thing. And even Good Times back in the 70s with J.J., all of those kind of movies were designed primarily, Norman Lear and back in the days of the early days of Amos and Andy, when they were using
Jack Benny and Rochester.
Yeah, it was all designed to make white people feel comfortable in the integration of black people. And then, of course, black people, since that's really all we had, that's all the comedy. I remember TV first came popular in the 50s. You know, that was all the comedy that we had. So, you know, we laughed at ourselves, but we laughed at ourselves. Now, from the perspective of being mean, we thought it was funny, too. I know I used to love Amos and Andy. And my favorite character was J. Algonquin Calhoun, the lawyer, because, you know me, I wanted to be intellectual. So I liked the way he used to mimic, you know, trying to speak properly and be making grammar mistakes. And he's supposed to be educated. I used to get a kick out of him.
Amos in that big old top hat was something else, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, Kingfish was the one that had the kind of like, what they call that type of top hat. I have one.
Derby.
Derby, yeah. He had a derby, and then I think Calhoun had like a Homburg. But in any event, I enjoyed those shows, just like I have enjoyed the Madea shows. I have enjoyed the Ice Cube Barbershop show. I like funny movies. I like black comedy. But I think that when they do it to entertain each other, that there's an undercurrent maybe that we may subconsciously relate to, but there's an undercurrent of actually putting down black people. And it's almost, to me, just this is my opinion, in kind of a mean way, where we don't mean it like that, but I think in a way they do. And that's why I have a problem with them doing it.
Well, they just may be entertaining themselves. Look at Al Jolson.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about him, too.
In France today, they still dress up in blackface. Over in the Netherlands, with Sinterklaas, they dress up in blackface. In Mexico, they got Mimi, the little monkey, on their postage stamps.
Well, you know, I grew up, and I suppose, you know, you're a little bit younger than me from what we've discussed in the past, but I think you probably relate to the racism of segregation, the open racism of those times, even if you didn't experience the brunt of it. I came up just as it was waning in terms of the legal segregation. But the truth of the matter is that I always felt very, very, very bitter. I'll just say it lightly. I got angry when I saw anybody, but especially, you know, people that were in my own neighborhood being mistreated just because we were Negro. Now, I was able to get away with a lot because of my color, my skin, you know, and so forth. My eyes are blue, gray eyes. So when I would go to the department store in Montgomery, Alabama, I would drink out of the white fountain, and I wouldn't worry about anybody saying anything, because what I didn't know at that time is that there was some kind of nappy-head white people, so they probably might have thought that I was one of those, and they never bothered me. But the fact is that they even had the signs, and I felt bad that the colored people, the black people, had to drink out of the what I call the hot water fountain. It wasn't really hot, but it was tepid, warm, and the other fountain was nice, cool. Well, I thought that was wrong, you know. Or even to go to the bus station and the white people have a nice restaurant, the colored people be crowded in a little cafe, you know, pushed together. You know, that stuff always bothered me. And so what I'm saying is this whole idea of the people, because they had the power to do it, trying to push black people under the bus, so to speak. Yeah, I never felt comfortable with that. And that's the reason why I don't think that, now that to get to the root of the question, I don't think the man should resign because of something he did 30 years ago. If he say his attitude has changed, but if he say, well, that's the way we was raised and that's the way I am, I don't think that person, if it was just all white state, fine. But you got a lot of black people living in Virginia. I used to live in Virginia. I graduated from high school in Virginia. All black people.
Well, you know, it's just like they are with Donald Trump. When people say he's a racist, I say, well, where is he? Show me what he's done that's racist. And everybody get quiet. They can't say nothing. Then people refer back to things in his past, and they want to hold it and say that his companies have filed bankruptcy. What the hell? Bankruptcy is allowed. Companies file bankruptcy. That's what you're supposed to do to protect the assets of the company.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to do because we can continue on that vein, but somebody just joined us. Let me at least welcome them and give them a chance to do some stuff, and then we'll get back to the point you're making. Because I was going to say he played golf with Tiger Woods yesterday, and we know Tiger Woods is pretty black, but anyway, that is a nice gesture that he did sitting on the golf course with Tiger Woods, so I had to give him $5 for that. But anyway, again, from
well, you got a lot of noise on that. I can hardly hear what y'all are saying.
That's not my noise, but I think it might be our guest. If you have some ground noise, if you want to switch, go ahead and turn off your background noise. Otherwise, I'm going to have to mute you out.
It's still hurting.
Okay, please check and see if you got noise in the background. I don't have no noise. I don't have any noise. So it's not me. It's not the PIP. If you just join the section, see if you have noise in the background.
There ain't none of my noise.
Well,
some woman talking.
Yeah, it was our guest that just came on from the 407 area code. I had to mute you out because your noise was coming across the air. So if you could just turn off your background noise, I would like to invite you to speak. Stay with us, please. We want to hear your opinion, but please turn off your background noise. That's our guest from the 407 area code, your last three digits of your phone number, 333. I'm going to turn you back on now so you can speak, but please make sure your background noise is turned off. All right, here we go.
Oh, I just called in to listen, but I'm sorry about the background noise. I got it down.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. How's it going tonight?
Oh, we're doing fine. Did you hear the topic for tonight? Do you want me to repeat the topic for tonight?
No, it's the topic everybody's talking about. He should step down. He shouldn't have got elected in the first place. But people don't look into the background enough anymore on these politicians. Most of them shouldn't be in there.
Well, Mr. Pianchi, he's one of our mainstays of the program. He's a veteran panelist. We've been on there together for the last 2 years. And I don't know if you heard his point of view, so let me let you hear his point of view, and then we could talk about it. Mr. Pierre, you want to reiterate your point of view concerning Dr. Northam stepping down?
Well, no, I don't think he should step down because of that. Now, if you want to put political reasons in there, the way Democrats have went after Republicans and like Justice Kavanaugh and Roy Moore down in Alabama and those allegations, yeah, I think he should. Fair about his fair play, but any other reason, no, I don't think he should sit down because of what he they say he done, acting out in blackface or donning a costume. I mean, that's what people done. They still do it. I know black people that do it.
Yeah, but we just had the Secretary of State here in Florida step down for the same reason 10 days ago.
Oh, well, that's Florida. I mean, if people in Florida wanted to do that, that's them. This man in Virginia, now, I think.
We didn't actually do it. He just did it on his own. You know,
yeah.
People. You know, he says, look, in light of the fact that I was dressed up like this, he says, I'm going to step down.
Well, you know, I like to bring this up. There was a Missouri State Fair where you had a rodeo clown, and he had on an Obama mask. Well, one of the state reps called for him to be fired. But you had another state rep by the name of Maria Chappelle Nadal. She wrote on her Twitter that I hope that he's assassinated, talking about Donald Trump. Well, she didn't step down. So you got these double standards that's going on.
Yeah, I hear you there, man. There's definitely a double standard. I think you're right there. But, you know, at the same time, the right move would be like the guy in Florida did. He stepped down. I don't think the guy in Virginia wants to, but I think he's going to get a lot of pressure, and I think he's going to.
Well, I don't know what happened to the guy in Florida, but something that people done, you know, years ago does not dictate.
He did the same exact thing. He had blackface on.
Yeah, that doesn't dictate what how they're going to operate today. You had a Supreme Court justice. You're right. You had a Supreme Court justice that served on the Supreme Court that was a former Klan member. And that was Hugo Black. And so, me personally, I would tell him to go to hell. I ain't stepping down.
Yeah, and that's what he's doing too. So God bless him, man. Good luck to him. But I think the mob mentality is going to get lynched. And he's gone.
You know, like I say, it's a double standard. Look on the web pages about all the females and these white females that having sex with students. Ain't nothing happening to them. Matter of fact, in Florida, the prosecutor, the state attorney, entered into a plea arrangement, a plea deal with one of those female teachers that had sex with one of her male students. What kind of crap is that?
I know they never get what you know, but there's a double standard. You're right. Well, thanks for talking, guys. I'm going to listen to you online now. Take care.
Oh, okay.
Keep up the good work.
We may wrap up sooner than the normal time if we don't get some more participation, because I think Ms. Bianchi, we pretty much dealt with it the way we're going to deal with it, and appreciate you.
And I hope you're right on it. I hope he hangs in there, but I think the mob's going to get him.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say 2 cents worth before you go. And that is the fact that I think that Americans are going to have to decide as a collective society, and you're going to have differences of opinion, but in general, whether our leaders are going to represent the ideals that we were taught as children, are the ideals of American democracy, of freedom, justice, and equality, or if that's just going to be a sham. And then it's just going to be a power between the different interest groups, whether it's the KKK, the Black Panthers, the Black Nationalists, or the everyday, white and black people. Because at some point, if things do not get worked out, all you're going to do is have a lot of people hating and fighting each other. And I don't think that's for our grandchildren, down the road. I think that's not what we would like to see America become.
Yeah, I agree with you. Very well said. All right, good night.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us. Well, Mr. Bianchi, I see us. We are halfway into the show. And
good, sir.
I see it's really attracted a lot of people to this conversation. I hope we get 3 or 4 more normal regulars, but for whatever reason, they haven't shown up. So I think I'm going to go ahead and just go ahead and put a plug, as they say, right now, as far as the conversation is concerned. But what I'm going to do is, just in case somebody joins, I'm going to play extracts from my book for another half an hour. And if you get off and you want to check back in after a while to see if anybody else is here, I will announce. And I see your number.
All
come
right.
Up
I'll talk to you later.
Okay. God bless. Take care. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Good evening, and this is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of the Honorable Booker T. Washington, the author of the book Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. We'd like to share some of our book with you this evening. In order to fully understand and appreciate the Black Revolutionary philosophy of the Honorable Dr. Booker T. Washington, it is necessary to review the degree of spiritual impoverishment that had come with the African-American slaves' relegation to the status of nearly inhuman chattel property. This spiritual impoverishment was the product of the cruelty and hopelessness that was endured by the black slaves, along with the wretched physical circumstances of their lives. The great abolitionist Frederick Douglass noted that, quote, the men and the women slaves on his slave master, Colonel Lloyd's farm, received as their monthly allowance of food 8 pounds of pickled pork, or its equivalent in fish. The pork was often tainted, spoiled, and wormy, and the fish were of the poorest quality. With their meat or fish, they had given them one bushel of Indian meal unbolted, of which quite 15% was more fit for pigs than for men. With this, 1 pint of salt was given. 1 pint of salt. And this was the entire monthly allowance of a full-grown slave working constantly in the open field from morning till night every day in the month except Sunday. There is no kind of work which really requires a better supply of food to prevent physical exhaustion than the field work of a slave. The yearly allowance of clothing was not more ample than the supply of food. It consisted of 2-toe linen shirts, like burlap bag material, and 1 pair of trousers of the same coarse material for summer, and a woolen pair of trousers and a woolen jacket for winter, with 1 pair of yarn stockings and a pair of the coarsest description. Children under 10 years old had neither shoes, stockings, jackets, nor trousers. They had 2 coarse towel linen, like burlap bag material, shirts, and when these were worn out, they went naked till the next allowance day. And this was the condition of the little girls as well as the boys. As to beds, they had none. 1 coarse blanket was given to them, and this only to the men and women. The children stuck themselves in holes and corners about the quarters, and often in the corners of huge chimneys, and put their feet in the ashes to keep them warm. Unquote. That's from Frederick Douglass' memoirs. When ambitious 25-year-old Booker T. Washington arrived in Macon County, Alabama, in the spring of 1881, he was fresh from a teaching position at Coastal Virginia's Hampton Institute. He had prepared himself to come to Alabama to teach. However, he knew absolutely nothing about the depths to which the former slaves had been degraded by their white masters. Little did he expect to be the black revolutionary that God had sent them, to completely change or revolutionize their lives. In his signature work, Up From Slavery, Booker T. Washington candidly confesses, "What I saw during my month of travel and investigation upon his arrival in Tuskegee, Alabama, in the spring of 1881, left me with a very heavy heart. The work to be done in order to lift these people up seemed almost beyond accomplishing. Of one thing, I felt more strongly convinced than ever, after spending this month in seeing the actual life of the colored people, and that was that in order to lift them up, something must be done more than merely to imitate New England education as it then existed." Unquote. It is interesting to note at this point that here is a young man quite new to the dangers inherent in being a black man in the hostile Deep South who has one single focus in his mind, that is to revolutionize, to change completely the impoverished and degraded lives of his fellow African Americans. Unlike later black revolutionaries who sought to bring about these changes through political agitation or threats of mob violence, as in the Watts riots that occurred 50 years after his death, Booker T. Washington was determined to use industriousness, education, and community development or nation building as the vehicle to lift the ex-slaves up as human beings and citizens of the United States of America. As stated, however, the type of education that he proposed was not the kind that was used to educate the already settled European Americans. Dr. Washington knew that teaching sharecroppers and tenant farmers how to read and write Greek and Latin or recite the romantic poetry of Wordsworth, Keats, Byron, and Shelley was not the most advantageous road to economic and cultural advancement for the newly emancipated slaves. Another black revolutionary, Professor W.E.B. Du Bois, a product of a New England Harvard education, opposed Booker T. Washington's method of uplifting the recently emancipated African Americans who lived in the Deep South. Although he had lived in urban Nashville, Tennessee, and Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Du Bois's appreciation for the day-to-day struggles of black and brown people lacked the depth of understanding that growing up on a Virginia slave plantation had given Booker T. Washington in his early life. Dr. Du Bois admitted that the prudent method of bringing about the cooperation of the European Americans and uplifting the African Americans was to weld the former slaves to the future industries of the South. Although he praised the accomplishments of the common schools and the trade schools, such as the Tuskegee Institute, headed by Booker T. Washington, Professor Du Bois firmly believed that it was the classical college education that would be the best vehicle to advance the masses of African Americans through the agency of the talented tenth. A few specially selected college-trained African-Americans. W.E.B. Du Bois's thinking was that, quote, within the minds of African-Americans there must come a loftier respect for the human soul that seeks to know itself and the world around it, that seeks a freedom for self-expansion and self-development. In achieving this ambitious goal of uplifting our people intellectually and culturally, W.E.B. Du Bois called upon classical intellectuals such as Aristotle, Balzac, Dumas, Aristotle, and Aurelius as beacons for African-American enlightenment. As a product of an excellent classical education myself from the University of California at Berkeley, Tuskegee University, Norwich University, Denver University, Augusta University, Northwest Missouri State University, and Alabama A&M Universities, I totally concur with Dr. Du Bois concerning the value of such learning and intellectual development. At the same time, however, I also concur with another black revolutionary, the Honorable Elijah X. Poole Muhammad. Messenger Muhammad, as he was respectfully called, advocated that African Americans or black people should get an education which will benefit their own people and not an education adding to the storehouse of their teacher. We need education, he said, but an education which removes us from the shackles of slavery and servitude. Get an education, but not an education which leaves us in an inferior position and without a future. Get an education, but not an education that leaves us looking to the slave masters for a job. Unquote. The founder of what has become nationally celebrated Black History Month, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, declared in his blistering critique the miseducation of the Negro that highly educated Negroes who advocate for a sort of education different only in some respects from that now given the white man, Negroes who have been so long inconvenienced and denied opportunities for development, are naturally afraid of anything that sounds like discrimination. They are anxious to have everything the white man has, even if it is harmful. The so-called modern education, with all its defects, however, does others so much more good than it does the Negro, because it has been worked out in conformity to the needs of those who have enslaved and oppressed weaker people. In the book Education in Alabama, Dr. Horace Mann Bond observed that the ongoing agenda of the Negro's former slave masters was clearly stated by post-emancipation white leaders, who said, quote, the Negro is considered hopelessly helpless by his want of self-reliance, by his want of experience, and his want of the ability to understand and appreciate his situation. And the former slave owners believe that the white man must secure the services of the Negroes and teach them their place, and convince African Americans that their best friends were the people who had raped, robbed, enslaved, and dehumanized them for 300 years without mercy or compassion. Within a writing 75 years after the end of slavery, Dr. Horace Mann Bond protested, quote, it is clear that the former slave owners never intended to accept the freedom of Negroes without the reservation that members of the race should continue to be wards and under the tutelage of the class which had owned them before the war. Thus, the concept envisioned by Booker T. Washington that African Americans should be educated to come into their own, independent of the inferiority conferring miseducation of their former slave masters, was truly revolutionary. In a quote from the Holy Bible from Nehemiah chapter 1 verse 10, now these are thy servants and thy people whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. And that is the end of the chapter, the end of the chapter, which is entitled The Introduction to the Book Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, authored by Marshall Washington Cabinet Sibuie, Master of Arts and Master of Education and PhD researcher, ABD, all but dissertation completed, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington.
To go ahead and share that part of our book with our audience. And we have just one other part that we would like to share before we sign off. And actually, this is from the same book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. And this chapter deals with education, and it deals with education for living.
This is the author of the book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, Marshall Washington Cabinet Sibuie, reading from my book, from Chapter 5, entitled Education for Living. Booker T. Washington presented a very viable program for the African Americans' development as a nation within a nation. A nation within a nation. He commented in an address presented during his tenure as president of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute that the educational leader must understand and appreciate the necessity for the race's learning the difference between being worked as in slavery and doing for self. Booker T. Washington continued by explaining that the wise leader would not confine the Negro to industrial life, but believes that the very best service which anyone can render to what is called the higher education is to teach the present generation to work and save. This will create the wealth from which alone can come leisure and the opportunity for higher education. One of the most fundamental and far-reaching deeds that has been accomplished during the last quarter of a century has been that by which the Negro has been helped to find himself, to reacquire the knowledge of self, and to learn the secrets of civilization, to learn that there are a few simple cardinal principles upon which a race must start its upward course, unless it would fail, and its last estate be worse than its first. It has been necessary for the Negro to learn the difference from being worked and working, to learn that being worked meant degradation, while working for self means civilization, and that all forms of labor are honorable and all forms of idleness disgraceful. It has been necessary for him to learn and for her to learn that all races that have gotten upon their feet have done so largely by lean and economic foundation, and in general by beginning in a proper understanding of the need for civilization and ownership of the soil. Booker T. Washington said that 40 years ago, he's speaking back in the early 1900s, 40 years ago, my race emerged from slavery into freedom. If in too many cases the Negro race began development at the wrong end, it was largely because neither white nor black properly understood the case. Nor is it any wonder that this is so, for never before in the history of the world had such a problem been presented as that of the two races at the coming of freedom in this country. He said that for 250 years, I believe the way for the redemption of the Negro was being prepared through industrial development. Through all those years, the Southern white man did business with the Negro in a way that no one else has done business with him. In most cases, if a Southern white man wanted a house built, he consulted a Negro mechanic or engineer about the plan, or architect about the plan and about the actual building of the structure. If he wanted a suit of clothes made, he went to a Negro tailor, and for shoes, he went to a shoemaker of the same race. In a certain way, every slave plantation in the South was an industrial school. On these plantations, young colored men and women were constantly being trained not only as farmers, but as carpenters, blacksmiths, wheelwrights, brick masons, engineers, cooks, laundresses, sewing women, and housekeepers. Booker T. Washington continues saying, I do not mean in any way to apologize for the curse of slavery, which was a curse to both races, but in what I say about industrial training in slavery, I am simply stating facts. This training was crude and was given for selfish purposes. It did not answer the highest ends because there was an absence of mental training in connection with the training of the hands. To a large degree, though, this business contact with the Southern white man and the industrial training on the plantations left the Negro at the close of the war in possession of nearly all the common and skilled labor in the South. The industries that gave the South its power, prominence, and wealth prior to the Civil War, were mainly the raising of cotton, sugar cane, rice, and tobacco. Before the way could be prepared for the proper growing and marketing of these crops, forests had to be cleared, houses had to be built, public roads and railroads constructed. In all these works, the Negro did most of the heavy work. In the planting, cultivating, and marketing of the crops, not only was the Negro the chief dependence, but in the manufacture of tobacco, he became a skilled and proficient workman. And in this, up to the present time in the South, he holds the lead in the large tobacco factories. In most of the industries, though, what happened? For nearly 20 years after the Civil War, except in a few instances, the value of the industrial training given by the plantations was overlooked. Negro men and women were educated in literature, in mathematics, and in the sciences, with little thought of what had been taking place during the preceding 250 years, except perhaps as something to be escaped, to be gotten away from as far as possible. As a generation began to pass, those who had been trained as mechanics and architects and engineers in slavery began to disappear by death, and gradually it began to be realized that there were few to take their places. There were young men educated in foreign tongues, in Greek and Latin and French, but few in carpentry or in mechanical or architectural drawing. Many were trained in Latin, but few as engineers and blacksmiths. Too many were taken from the farm and educated, but they were educated in everything but farming. For this reason, they had no interest in farming, and they did not return to it. And yet 85% of the Negro population of the southern states, at that time anyway, lived, and for a considerable time, Booker T. Washington expected that they would continue to live in the country districts. And he continues, "The charge is often brought against the members of my race, and too often justly, I confess, that they are found leaving the country districts and flocking into the great cities where temptations are more frequent and harder to resist, where the Negro people too often become demoralized. Think, though, how frequently it is the case that from the first day that a pupil begins to go to school, his books teach him much about the cities of the world and city life, and almost nothing about the country. How natural it is, then, that when he has the ordering of his life, he wants to live it in the city." And then Booker T. Washington continues, "Only a short time before his death, the late Mr. Collis P. Huntington, to whose memory a magnificent library had just recently been given by his widow to the Hampton Institute in Virginia, said in a public address some words which seemed to me so wise that I want to quote them here." And this is a quotation from the late Collis P. Huntington, the railroad magnate. "Our schools teach everyone a little of almost everything, but in my opinion, they teach very few children just what they ought to know in order to make their way successfully in life. They do not put into the hands of the children the tools that they are best fitted to use, and hence so many failures. Many a mother and sister have worked and slaved, living upon scanty food, in order to give a son and brother a liberal education, and in doing this, have built up a barrier between the boy and the work he was fitted to do. Let me say to you that all honest work is honorable work. If the labor is manual and seems common, you will have all the more chance to be thinking of other things or of work that is higher and brings better pay, and to work out in your minds better and higher duties and responsibilities for yourselves, and for thinking of ways by which you can help others as well as yourselves bring them up to your own higher level," unquote. Booker T. Washington also recalled that, quote, "Some years ago when we decided to make tailoring a part of our training at the Tuskegee Institute, I was amazed to find that it was almost impossible to find in the whole country an educated colored man who could teach the making of clothing. We could find numbers of them who could teach astronomy, theology, Latin, or grammar, but almost none who could instruct in the making of clothing, something that has to be used by every one of us every day in the year. How often have I been discouraged as I have gone through the South and into the homes of the people of my race and have found women who could converse intelligently upon abstruse subjects and yet could not tell how to improve the condition of the poorly cooked and still more poorly served bread and meat which they and their families were eating three times a day. It is discouraging to find a girl who can tell you the geographical location of any country on the globe and who does not know where to place the dishes upon a common dinner table. It is discouraging to find a woman who knows much about theoretical chemistry and who cannot properly wash and iron a shirt. In what I say here, I would not by any means have it understood that I would limit or circumscribe the mental development of the Negro student. No race can be lifted until its mind is awakened and strengthened. By the side of industrial training should always go mental and moral training, but the pushing of mere abstract knowledge into the head means little. Our knowledge must be harnessed to the things of real life. Our knowledge must be harnessed to the things of real life. I would encourage the Negro to secure all the mental strength, all the mental culture, whether gleaned from studying science, mathematics, history, language, or literature, that his circumstances will allow. But I believe most earnestly that for years to come, the education of the people of my race should be so directed that the greatest proportion of the mental strength of the masses will be brought to bear upon the everyday practical things of life, upon something that is needed to be done, and something which they will be permitted to do in the community where they reside. And just the same with the professional class which the race needs and must have, I would say, give the men and women of that class, too, the training which will best fit them to perform in the most successful manner the service which the race demands. I would not confine the Negro race to industrial life, not even to agriculture, for example, although I believe that by far the greater part of the Negro race is best off in the country districts and must and should continue to live there. But I would teach the race that in industry, the foundation must be laid, that the very best service which anyone can render to what is called the higher education is to teach the present generation to provide a material or industrial foundation. On such a foundation as this will grow habits of thrift, a love of work, economy, ownership of property, and bank accounts. And out of it, in the future, will grow practical education, professional education, positions of public responsibility, and out of it will grow moral and religious strength. Out of it will grow wealth, from which alone can come leisure and the opportunity for the enjoyment of literature and the fine arts. In the words of the late beloved Frederick Douglass, quote, every blow of the sledgehammer wielded by a black arm, a brown arm, is a powerful blow in the support of our cause. Every colored mechanic is by virtue of circumstances an elevator of his race. Every house built by a black man is a strong tower against the allied hosts of prejudice. It is impossible for us to attach too much importance to this aspect of the subject. Without industrial development, there can be no wealth, and without wealth, there can be no leisure. Without leisure, no opportunity for thoughtful reflection and the cultivation of the higher arts. Unquote. Booker T. Washington repeatedly reminded his questioners, saying, I would set no limits to the attainments of the Negro in arts, in letters, or statesmanship, but I believe the surest way to reach those ends is by laying the foundation in the little things of life and that lie immediately about one's door. I believe the surest way to reach those goals is by laying the foundation in the little things of life that lie immediately about one's door. I plead for industrial education and industrial development, the building of industries, factories, farms, service occupations for the Negro, not because I want to cramp him, but because I want to free him. I want to see him enter the all-powerful business and commercial worlds. It was such combined mental, moral, and industrial education which gave the late General Samuel Chapman Armstrong, the founder of the Hampton University, which the late Samuel Chapman Armstrong set out to give at the Hampton Institute when he established that school 30 years ago. And this is, again, Booker T. Washington speaking in the early 1900s, or late 1800s. The Hampton Institute has continued along the lines laid down by its great founder, and now each year an increasing number of similar schools are being established in the South for the people of both races. Early in the history of the Tuskegee Institute, we began to combine industrial training with mental and moral culture. Our first efforts were in the direction of agriculture, and we began teaching this with no appliances except one hoe and a blind mule. From this small beginning, we have grown until now the Institute owns 2,000 acres of land, 800 of which are cultivated each year by the young men of the school. We began teaching wheel writing and blacksmithing in a small way to the men, and laundry work, cooking and sewing, and housekeeping to the young women. The 1,400 and over young men and women who attended the school during the last school year received instruction, in addition to academic and religious training, in 33 trades and industries, including carpentry, blacksmithing, printing, wheelwriting, harnessing, painting, machinery, founding, shoemaking, brick masonry and brick making, plastering, sawmilling, tinsmithing, tailoring, mechanical and architectural drawing, electrical and steam engineering, or automotive engineering, canning, sewing, dressmaking, millinery, hat making, cooking, laundry, and housekeeping, mattress making, basketry, nursing, agriculture, dairying, and stock raising, as well as horticulture. Not only do the students receive instruction in these trades, but they do actual work, by means of which more than half of them pay some part or all of their expenses while remaining at the school. Of the 60 buildings belonging to the school, all but four were almost wholly erected by the students as part of their industrial education. Even the bricks which go into the walls are made by students in the school's brickyard, in which last year they manufactured 2 million bricks. When we first began this work at Tuskegee and the idea got spread among the people of my race that the students who came to the Tuskegee school were to be taught industries in connection with their academic studies, were in other words to be taught to work, I received a great many verbal messages and letters from parents informing me that they wanted their children taught books, but not how to work. This protest went on for 3 or 4 years, but I am glad to be able to say now that our people have very generally been educated to a point where they see their own needs and conditions so clearly that it has been several years since we have had a single protest from parents against the teaching of industries, and now there is a positive enthusiasm for it. In fact, public sentiment among the students at Tuskegee is now so strong for industrial training that it would hardly permit a student to remain on the grounds who was unwilling to labor. It seems to me that too often mere book education leaves the Negro young man or woman in a weak position. For example, I have seen a Negro girl taught by her mother to help her in doing laundry work at home. Later, when this same girl was graduated from the public schools or a high school and returned home, she finds herself educated out of sympathy with laundry work, and yet she is not able to find anything to do which seems in keeping with the cost and character of her education. Under these circumstances, we cannot be surprised if she does not fulfill the expectations made for her. What should have been done for her, it seems to me, was to give her, along with her academic education, thorough training in the latest and best methods of laundry work, so that she could have put so much skill and intelligence into it that the work would have been lifted out from the plane of drudgery. The home which she would then have been able to found by the results of her work would have enabled her to help her children to take a still more responsible position in life. Almost from the first, Tuskegee has kept in mind, and I think this should be the policy of all industrial schools, fitting students for occupations which would be open to them in their home communities. Some years ago, we noted the fact that there was beginning to be a demand in the South for men to operate dairies in a skillful modern manner. We opened a dairy department in connection with the school where a number of young men could have instruction in the latest and most scientific methods of dairy work. At present, we have calls mainly from southern white men for twice as many dairymen as we are able to supply. What is equally satisfactory, the reports which come to us indicate that our young men are giving the highest satisfaction and are fast changing and improving the dairy product in the communities into which they go. I use the dairy here as an example. What I've said of this is equally true of many other industries which we teach. Aside from the economic value of this work, I cannot but believe, and my observation confirms me in my belief, that as we continue to place Negro men and women of intelligence, religion, modesty, conscience, and skill in every community in the South, who will prove by actual results their value to the community, I cannot but believe, I say, that this will constitute a solution to many of the present political and social difficulties. Many seem to think that industrial education is meant to make the Negro work as he worked in the days of slavery. This is far from my conception of industrial education. If this training is worth anything to the Negro, it consists of in teaching him how not to work, but how to make the forces of nature, air and steam and water and horsepower and electricity work for him. If it has any value, it is in lifting labor out of the toil and drudgery into that beautiful and dignified plane of excellence. The Negro in the South works, and he works hard, and she works hard, but too often his or her ignorance and lack of skill causes him or her to do their work in the most costly and shiftless manner, and this keeps them near the bottom of the ladder in the economic world. I have not emphasized particularly in these pages the great need of training the Negro in agriculture, but I believe that this branch of industrial education does need very great emphasis. We're going to stop right there. We're going to end our reading of my book for now, and we'll resume at another time. But we certainly want to encourage you to stay tuned and listen to our commercial for the book so you can find out, again, how to order the book to put it in your library. Thank you very much. This is Marshall Washington Cabinets, the author of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, also founding owner of Reality Books Publications.
I want to thank you all who listened to that advertisement for our book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. And we see now that our dearly beloved sister-in-law has joined us for the second hour of our program. I don't know if we'll go for a whole hour, but we certainly want to hear from you, Stephanie, on our topic tonight. Ms. Bianchi has left. We may hear from him again tonight. I don't know. We did have another guest from Florida who said that he would be listening via the internet after he spoke live on the show. Right now, it's just you and myself. So I want to reiterate our topic. And our topic for tonight is, should the governor of Virginia, Dr. Ralph Northam, resign amid allegations that he appeared in blackface with another student who was dressed as a Ku Klux Klansman in his medical school yearbook. So there's a big clamor that was in the news today, and I think yesterday and maybe the day before, where many people are calling for this governor of Virginia to resign because he, 30 years ago, was pictured in his medical school yearbook dressed in blackface and standing next to another person, I imagine a student, who was dressed as a Ku Klux Klan person. And, of course, there are pros and cons on this. Some people say it happened so long ago it shouldn't be relevant. He said that wasn't him in the picture, and that when the yearbook was made, they probably used another picture and put it on his page. And he said he never saw the picture until now because he did not buy a copy of the yearbook, which seems very, very unlikely to me that he would have never, even if he didn't buy the yearbook, that he would have never wanted to have a friend of his, a classmate or someone, show him the yearbook so he could see, you know, reminisce over the other events. So I don't buy that, but he's saying basically he used to be kind of like that kind of person anyway, but that's not who he is today. And he said he's not going to resign. So what do you think, Stephanie?
Well, I also saw the post. I read up on it on Facebook. I think, number one, we need to look and see what type of things he's done since he's been in office as the governor of Virginia. Does he carry any of those type of qualities? Number two, we don't need people like that over any of our government. But number three, we can't be prehistorical monsters. People do change. People may have done things when they were young that they have totally changed from. But at the age he was, that should not have been. Basically, they need to go by, I think, what type of person has he been since he's been in office for the past 30 years as governor of Virginia? And hopefully it wasn't him. Because, like I said, we don't meet those type of people. I agree. I don't believe that he has never seen that yearbook. Everyone would want their yearbook. That's just my opinion. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. We're not going to actually go back and forth on because I actually agree. I believe that people can change, but I do also feel that he should not be lying about it. If, in fact, he did do it, he should come clean and say, you know, that's how I was 30 years ago. I've evolved. My mind is more broad-minded. I don't feel that it's appropriate to make fun of black people by appearing in blackface type of costumes. And please accept the fact that my record over the years has indicated that I am fair and open-minded. I treat all people with respect. And if I were him, I would even go so far as to ask patients if he, you know, practice medicine. I don't know how long he's been in politics, but if he practiced medicine since graduating from medical school, if he's had African-American colleagues, co-workers, patients, even people, black people that he may have supervised in his residency and hospitals to justify that they've never seen any evidence that he looks down on black people. And then he could establish his credibility as a person that is not a bigot, that's fair and open-minded, because I personally grew up in an era when the leadership of the country, at least in many southern states where I grew up in Alabama, the people were pronounced out-and-out vocal bigots. I remember my governor when I was a young man in high school back in around 1983. Actually, I was in the military, I think, at that time, just graduated from high school. And he stood in front of the door of the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. And after being forced by the federal government to allow a black student, a graduate student, to enter the university for the first time, he made a speech and he said, segregation yesterday, segregation today, and segregation forever. And he was very, very bigoted at that time. But many years later, the same man appointed me as a officer, as a honorary lieutenant colonel in the militia of the state of Alabama under his governorship. And so apparently something happened after he got shot when he was running for president that at least made him seem to have changed his heart. I don't know if he had ever appointed an African-American to that lofty official military honorary position before, but I have to give him credit for what he did too in my case, even though before that he was a man that I think caused a lot of grief for many black people. So I believe people can change. The question is, in my mind, not so much about what he did 30 years ago, but what is his attitude now, and is he telling the truth? Because if he's one of those people that's going to conveniently lie when he's brought on allegations that are really factual, then he shouldn't be trusted. And if he can't be trusted, he should not be a governor of any state. So anyway, I just wanted to say that to close off and give you an opportunity to respond if you wanted to respond to that.
I agree with you totally. I hold the same position and thoughts and things of that sort on that subject. I agree with you totally. I guess what goes on in the dark is surely to come to the light. But the people of Virginia who he has been reigning over, they would know.
Totally agree. I'm not for having a media lynching of the man without having the real person, the gentleman who has been elected popularly in that state, have a fair hearing. But I just feel uncomfortable if he's lying, try to keep his job, because it's going to come out, and then in the end, if it does come out, people are going to, you know, come out and give the real story of what happened. If people probably, the photographer who took the picture may be still living. In any event, he's going to be really embarrassed if he's holding out thinking he's going to get away, if in fact it was him in the picture. So, yes, anyway, I think, you know, that we could go on and on, but I think we basically hit the high points of that particular news issue, and so I'm not going to prolong it, but I want to say thank you for joining us tonight. It's always great to have you on the show with
thank
the comments. Anyway, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up now, since we don't have any other callers, unless you wanted to, you know, say some final comment.
No, thank you for having me.
Okay, Stephanie, thank you. We're going to close out for the benefit of our regular listeners and those who are joining us for the first time. We always like to close out with the song popularly known as the Black National Anthem. So we're going to go ahead and in just a minute we'll just play that and we'll say good night to everyone. May you have a safe weekend. The rest of that is in front of us. Tomorrow, Sunday, and may you have a very wonderful week coming up as we get into the last month of winter. In some places, it's been a terrible winter, but we hope that things will get better as we get into the months of spring that are coming rather soon. Hopefully, it'll warm up all over by the middle of March. So thank you, God bless you.